sample of the biological differences that exist between males and females. The differences between the sexes are in fact more profound than those that exist among human populations, reflecting more than 100 million years of evolution and adaptation. Males and females differ by huge tracts of genetic material. A Y chromosome that males have and that females don't, and a second X chromosome that females have and males don't. Most people accept that the biological differences between males and females are profound, and that they contribute to average differences in size and physical strength, as well as in temperament and behavior, even if there are questions about the extent to which particular differences are also influenced by social expectations and upbringing. For example, many of the jobs in industry and the professions that women fill in great numbers today had few women in them a century ago. Today we aspire both to recognize that biological differences exist and to accord everyone the same freedoms and opportunities regardless of them. It is clear from the abiding average inequities that persist between women and men that fulfilling these aspirations is a challenge. And yet, it is important to accommodate and even embrace the real differences that exist, while at the same time struggling to get to a better place. The real offense of racism, in the end, is to judge individuals by a supposed stereotype of their group. To ignore the fact that when applied to specific individuals, stereotypes are almost always misleading. Statements such as, "You are black, you must be musical," or "You are Jewish, you must be smart," are unquestionably very harmful. Everyone is his or her own person, with unique strengths and weaknesses, and should be treated as such. Suppose you are the coach of a track and field team, and a young person walks on and asks to try out for the 100-meter race, in which people of West African ancestry are statistically highly overrepresented, suggesting the possibility that genetics may play a role. For a good coach, race is irrelevant. Testing the young person's sprinting speed is simple. Take him or her out to the track to run against the stopwatch. Most situations are like this. A new basis for identity. The genome revolution is actually a far more effective force for coming to a new understanding of human difference and identity, for understanding our own personal place in the world around us, than for promoting old beliefs that more often than not are mistaken. To understand the power of the genome revolution for undermining old stereotypes about identity and building up a new basis for identity, consider how its finding of repeated mixture in human history has destroyed nearly every argument that used to be made for biologically based nationalism. The Nazi ideology of a pure, Indo-European-speaking Aryan race with deep roots in Germany, traceable through artifacts of the corded ware culture, has been shattered by the finding that the people who used these artifacts came from a mass migration from the Russian steppe, a place that German nationalists would have despised as a source. The Hindutva ideology, that there was no major contribution to Indian culture from migrants from outside South Asia, is undermined by the fact that approximately half of the ancestry of Indians today is derived from multiple waves of mass migration from Iran and the Eurasian steppe within the last 5,000 years. Similarly, the idea that the Tutsis in Rwanda and Burundi have ancestry from West Eurasian farmers that Hutus do not, an idea that has been incorporated into arguments for genocide, is nonsense. We now know that nearly every group living today is the product of repeated population mixtures that have occurred over thousands and tens of thousands of years. Mixing is in human nature, and no one population is, or could be, pure. Non-scientists have already realized the potential of the genome revolution for forming new narratives. African Americans have been at the forefront of this movement. During the slave trade, Africans were uprooted and forcibly deprived of their culture, with the effect that within a few generations, much of their ancestors' religion, language, and traditions were gone. In 1976, Alex Haley's novel, Roots, used literature to begin to reclaim lost roots by recounting the odyssey of the slave Kunta Kinte and his descendants. Following in this tradition, Harvard professor of literature Henry Louis Gates Jr., has capitalized on the potential of genetic studies to recover lost roots for African Americans. In his Faces of Americans television series and the Finding Your Roots series that followed it, he declares to the cellist Yo-Yo Ma, who is able to trace his ancestry back to 13th century China, that Gates, as an African American, will never know how that feels. But he shows that genetics can provide richly informative insights, even for African Americans with limited genealogical records. A new industry, personal ancestry testing, has sprung up to capitalize on the potential of the genome revolution, to form the basis for new narratives, and to compare the genomes of consumers to others who have already been tested. The television programs that Gates has produced have been built around the idea of tracing the genealogies and DNA of celebrity guests, using the literary device of telling the personal stories of famous people to help viewers understand the power of genetic data to reveal features of their family's past about which they could not otherwise have been aware. For example, the programs revealed unknown deep relationships between pairs of guests on the program, shared ancestors within the last few hundred years. They also used genetic tests to determine not only the continents on which people's ancestors lived, but also the regions within continents. As a white person in the United States, with its history of forcible deprivation of peoples of their roots, I feel that everyone, African Americans and Native Americans especially, has the right to try to use genetic data to help fill in missing pieces in his or her family history. Nevertheless, for those who assume that personal ancestry testing results have the authority of science, it is important to keep in mind that many of the results are easily misinterpreted and rarely include the warnings that scientists attach to tentative findings. Some of the best examples come from the industry that sprang up to provide genetic results to African Americans. One company is African Ancestry, which provides customers with information on the West African tribe and country in which their Y chromosome or mitochondrial DNA type is most common. Such results are easy to overinterpret, as the frequencies of Y chromosome and mitochondrial DNA types are too similar across West Africa to make exact determinations with confidence. As an example, consider a Y chromosome type that is carried slightly more often in the Hausa ethnic group than in the neighboring Yoruba, Mende, Fulani, and Beni groups. When African Ancestry sends its report, it might state that an African American man has a Y chromosome type that is most common in the Hausa. But it is quite possible and even likely that the true ancestor was not the Hausa, because there are many tribes in West Africa and no one tribe contributed more than a modest fraction of the African ancestry of African Americans. And yet, people who have taken these tests often return with the impression that they know their origin. The geneticist Rick Kittles, a population geneticist who is the co-founder of African Ancestry, described this feeling, asserting, "My female line goes back to northern Nigeria, the land of the Hausa tribe. I then went to Nigeria and talked to people and learned about the Hausa's culture and tradition. That gave me a sense about who I am." Whole genome ancestry tests, in theory, have much more power than tests based on Y chromosomes and mitochondrial DNA. But at present, even whole genome methods are not good enough to provide high-resolution information about where the ancestors of an African-American person lived within Africa, in part because of the databases of present-day populations in West Africa are not complete enough. Much more research needs to be done to make it possible to carry out studies like these with any reliability. For African Americans, another frustration may be that the cultural upheaval that occurred after African slaves arrived in North America has been so enormous that today there are few differences among African Americans with respect to the places in Africa from which their ancestors came. Africans from one part of the continent were traded around and mixed with those from another, with the result that within a few generations, the great cultural diversity and variation of ancestry that existed among the first slaves were blurred to the point of unrecognizability. The nearly complete homogenization of African ancestry that occurred was evident in an unpublished study I carried out in 2012 with Kasia Britz, who analyzed genome-wide data from more than 15,000 African Americans from Chicago, New York, San Francisco, Mississippi, North Carolina, and the South Carolina Sea Islands. and tested if some African American populations were more closely related to particular West Africans than others, as might be expected based on the heterogeneous supply routes for U.S. slaves. It made sense to expect some differences. Of the four big slave ports, New Orleans was supplied mostly by French slave traders, whereas Baltimore, Savannah, and Charleston were supplied mostly by the British, drawing from different points in Africa. But what we found is that the mixing of the West African ancestors of African Americans has been so thorough that we could not detect any differences in the African source populations for mainland populations. Only in the Sea Islands off South Carolina did we detect evidence of a particular connection to one place in Africa, in this case to people of the country of Sierra Leone, the place of origin of the language with an African grammar still spoken by Gullah Sea Islanders. It will take ancient DNA studies of first-generation enslaved Africans to actually trace roots to Africa. The problem with the results sometimes provided by personal ancestry testing companies is not limited to African Americans. It is a more general pitfall that stems from the financial incentive that such companies have to provide people with what feel like meaningful findings. This is a problem even for the most rigorous of the companies. Between 2011 and 2015, the genetic testing company 23andMe provided customers with an estimate of their proportion of Neanderthal ancestry, allowing them to make a personal connection to the research showing that non-Africans derive around 2% of their genomes from Neanderthals. The measurement made by the test was highly inaccurate, however, since the true variation in Neanderthal proportion within most populations is only a few tenths of a percent, and the test reports variation of a few percentage points. Several people have told me excitedly that their 23andMe Neanderthal testing result put them in the top few percent of people in the world in Neanderthal ancestry. But because of the test's inaccuracies, the probability that people who got such a high 23andMe Neanderthal reading really do have more than the average proportion of Neanderthal ancestry is only slightly greater than 50-50. I raised this problem to members of the 23andMe team and even highlighted the problems in a 2014 scientific paper. Later, 23andMe changed its report to no longer provide these statements. However, the company continues to provide its customers with a ranking of the number of Neanderthal-derived mutations they carry. This ranking, too, does not provide strong evidence that customers have inherited more Neanderthal DNA than their population average. Not all the findings reported by the personal ancestry companies are inaccurate, and many people have obtained what for them is satisfying information from such testing, especially when it comes to tracing genealogies where the paper trail runs cold. One example is adoptees seeking their biological parents. Another is tracking down extended families. From my own perspective, though, I do not find this approach to be satisfying. In preparing to write this book, I considered whether I should send my DNA to a personal testing company, or study it in my own lab, and then describe the results, in imitation of the approach taken by many journalists covering the field of personal ancestry testing. But honestly, I am not interested. My own group, Ashkenazi Jews, is already overstudied. I am confident that my genome will be much like that of anyone else from this population. I would much rather use any resources I have to sequence the genomes of people who are understudied. I am also worried about the intellectual pitfall of self-study. I am innately suspicious of scientists who are hyper-interested in their own family or culture. They simply care too much. In my own laboratory, there are researchers from all over the world, and I encourage them, not always successfully, to choose projects on peoples not their own. For me, the approach of using the genome as a tool to connect myself to the world around me through personal links of family and tribe seems parochial and unfulfilling. What the genome revolution has given us, though, is an even more important way to come to grips with who we are, a way to hold in our minds the extraordinary human diversity that exists today and has existed in our past. The problem of understanding the connections between self and the world is a central one for me, and has driven my lifelong interest in geography, history, and biology. Ironically, for a person like myself, who is not at all religious, it is an example from the Bible that provides me with insight into how the genome revolution might be able to help solve this existential problem. Every year on the holiday of Passover, Jews sit around the dinner table and recount the story of the Exodus from Egypt. The Passover holiday is important to Jews because it reminds them of their place in the world and encourages them to draw lessons about how they should behave. This narrative has been extraordinarily successful, as measured by the fact that it has sustained Jews in their identity for thousands of years as a minority living in foreign lands. The Passover story begins with the myth of the patriarchs in ancient Israel, the first generation of Abraham and Sarah, the second of Isaac and Rebekah, the third of Jacob, Leah, Rachel, Bilhah, and Zilpah, and the fourth generation of 12 male children, the forefathers of the tribes of Israel, and a daughter, Dinah. These people are too removed from the huge populations of today to seem meaningfully connected to the present. The literary device that connects this ancient family to the multitudes that follow is Joseph, one of the sons of Jacob, who is sold by his brothers into slavery in Egypt, and who rises to a position of great power. When a famine strikes the land, the rest of the family also migrates to Egypt, where they are welcomed by Joseph, despite the earlier crime they had committed against him. 400 years pass, and their descendants exponentially multiply into a nation, numbering more than 600,000 military-age men, and an even larger number of women and children. Under the leadership of Moses, they break their bonds of oppression, wander for dozens of years, and work out their code of laws. They then return to the promised land of their ancestors. After reading the Passover story, Jews intuitively understand how within their population, numbering millions of people, they are related to each other and the past. This story allows Jews to think of those millions of co-religionists as direct relations, and to treat them with equal respect and seriousness, even if they do not understand their exact relationships. To break out from the trap of thinking of the world from the perspective of the relatively small families we were raised in. For me, the multitude of interconnected populations that have contributed to each of our genomes provide a similar narrative that helps me to understand my own place in the world and to avoid being daunted by the vast number of people in our species, the immensity of the human population numbering in the billions, the centrality of mixture in the history of our species, as revealed in just the last few years by the genome revolution, means that we are all interconnected, and that we will all keep connecting with one another in the future. This narrative of connection allows me to feel Jewish, even if I may not be descended from the matriarchs and patriarchs of the Bible. I feel American, even if I am not descended from indigenous Americans or the first European or African settlers. I speak English, a language not spoken by my ancestors 100 years ago. I come from an intellectual tradition, the European Enlightenment, which is not that of my direct ancestors. I claim these as my own, even if they were not invented by my ancestors, even if I have no close genetic relationship to them. Our particular ancestors are not the point. The genome revolution provides us with a shared history that, if we pay proper attention, should give us an alternative to the evils of racism and nationalism, and make us realize that we are all entitled equally to our human heritage. 12. The Future of Ancient DNA. The Second Scientific Revolution in Archaeology. The first scientific revolution in archaeology began in 1949, when the chemist Willard Libby made a discovery that would transform the field forever and win him the Nobel Prize 11 years later. He showed that by measuring the fraction of carbon atoms in ancient organic remains that carry 14 nucleons instead of the more common 12 or 13, he could determine the date when the carbon first entered the food chain. On Earth, the radioactive isotope carbon-14 is mostly formed through the bombardment of the atmosphere by cosmic rays, maintaining the proportion of all carbon atoms of this type at a level of about 1 part per trillion. During photosynthesis, plants pull carbon out of the atmosphere and change it into sugar. From there, it gets integrated into all the other molecules of life. After a living thing dies, half the carbon-14 atoms decay into nitrogen-14 within 5,730 years. This means the fraction of all carbon atoms in ancient remains that have 14 nucleons decreases in a known way, enabling scientists to determine a date for when the carbon entered a living thing, as long as the date is less than about 50,000 years ago. Beyond that, the fraction of carbon-14 is too low to make a measurement. Radiocarbon dating transformed archaeology, making it possible to determine the true age of materials, going beyond what was possible by studying the layering of remains. The discoveries that archaeologists made were profound. In Before Civilization, the Radiocarbon Revolution and Prehistoric Europe, Colin Renfrew described how radiocarbon dating showed that human prehistory extended much further back in time than had previously been thought, and described how the radiocarbon revolution overturned the assumption that all major innovations in European prehistory were imports from the Near East. While farming and writing were indeed of Near Eastern origin, innovations in metalworking and monumental constructions, such as the building of megaliths like those at Stonehenge, were not derived from ancient Egypt or Greece. These findings, and many other discoveries about the true age of ancient remains, sparked a new appreciation for indigenous cultures everywhere. The penetration of radiocarbon dating into every aspect of archaeology is evident from the more than 100 radiocarbon laboratories that provide dating to archaeologists as a service, and also from the fact that one of the basic skills serious archaeologists learn in graduate school is how to critically interpret radiocarbon dates. Radiocarbon dating has even changed archaeologists' yardstick for time. The ancient Chinese measured years since emperors ascended the throne, the Romans since the mythical foundation of their city, and the Jews since the date of the creation of the world according to the Bible. Almost everyone today denominates years before or after the supposed birth date of Jesus. For archaeologists, time is now measured as the number of radiocarbon decay years before present, BP, defined as 1950, the approximate year when Willard Libby discovered radiocarbon dating. The radiocarbon revolution transformed the discipline of archaeology into one that by the 1960s was no longer only a branch of the humanities, and instead now had equally strong roots in the sciences, with a high standard of evidence now required to support claims. Many additional scientific techniques were adopted by archaeologists in the period that followed, including flotation to identify ancient plant remains and study of ratios of atomic isotopes beyond those of carbon to determine the types of foods peoples and animals ate and whether they moved across the landscape in their lifetimes. The rich new suite of scientific tools that archaeologists now had at their disposal made it possible for them to analyze the sites they excavated in ways that had not been possible for earlier generations of archaeologists, and to arrive at insights that were more reliable. It is tempting to view ancient DNA as just one more new scientific technology that became available to archaeologists after the radiocarbon revolution, but that would be underestimating it. Prior to ancient DNA, archaeologists had hints of population movements based on the changes in the shapes of ancient skeletons and the types of artifacts people made. But these data were hard to interpret. But by sequencing whole genomes from ancient people, it is now possible to understand in exquisite detail how everyone is related. The measure of a revolutionary technology is the rate at which it reveals surprises, and in this sense, ancient DNA is more revolutionary than any previous scientific technology for studying the past, including radiocarbon dating. A more apt analogy is the 17th century invention of the light microscope, which made it possible to visualize the world of microbes and cells that no one before had even imagined. When a new instrument opens up vistas onto a world that has not previously been explored, everything it shows is new, and everything is a surprise. This is what is happening now with ancient DNA. It is providing definitive answers to questions about whether changes in the archaeological record reflect movements of people or cultural communication. Again and again, it is revealing findings that almost no one expected. An Ancient DNA Atlas of Humanity. So far, the ancient DNA revolution has been highly Eurocentric. Of 551 published samples with genome-wide ancient DNA data as of late 2017, almost 90% are from West Eurasia. The focus on West Eurasia is a reflection of the fact that it is in Europe that most of the technology for ancient DNA analysis was developed. And it is in Europe that archaeologists have been studying their own backyards and collecting remains for the longest period of time. But the ancient DNA revolution is spreading and has already produced several startling discoveries about human history outside of West Eurasia, most notably about the peopling of the Americas and of the remote Pacific Islands, as technical improvements have now made it possible to get ancient DNA from warm and even tropical places. I have no doubt that within the next decade, ancient DNA from Central Asia, South Asia, East Asia, and Africa will reveal equally great surprises. The product of this effort will be an ancient DNA atlas of humanity, sampled densely through time and space. This will be a resource that I think will rival the first maps of the globe made between the 15th and 19th centuries in terms of its contribution to human knowledge. The atlas will not answer every question about population history, but it will provide a framework, a baseline, to which we will always return when studying new archaeological sites. There is every reason to expect an avalanche of major discoveries from ancient DNA over the coming years as this atlas is built. One of the key frontiers that has hardly been touched by ancient DNA is the period between 4,000 years ago and the present. The great majority of samples studied so far have been older, but of course we know from the written record as well as from archaeological evidence that more recent times, the period of the development of writing, complex stratified societies and empires, have been extraordinarily eventful. The corpus of ancient DNA data even in West Eurasia is like a highway overpass still under construction and ending in midair, not quite connecting the populations of the past to those of the present. Using DNA to address what happened in this period will surely add to what we know from other disciplines. To bridge the last 4,000 years, to connect the past to the present, it is not sufficient to simply collect ancient DNA data from recent periods. The statistical methods that have worked so well for studying the earlier periods break down when examining data from more recent times. In particular, the methods based on four population tests owe their power to measuring the proportions of ancestry from populations that are highly differentiated. The very different ancestries act like tracer dyes, whose changing proportions can be tracked. However, in Europe, where we have made most progress in the ancient DNA revolution so far, we know that by 4,000 years ago, many populations were already highly similar in their ancestry composition to those of today. For example, in Britain, we know that beginning after 4,500 years ago, with people who buried their dead in association with wide-mouthed bell beaker pots, ancient Britons harbored a blend of ancestries very similar to that of present-day Britons. Yet it would be a mistake to conclude from this that the people of Britain today are descended without mixture from the beaker folk. In fact, Britain's population has been transformed by multiple subsequent waves of migration of continental people, who were genetically similar to the people associated with beaker burials. New, more sensitive methods are needed to determine how much ancestry in Britain derives from later waves. To address this challenge, statistical geneticists are developing a new class of methods that make it possible to track mixtures and migrations, even of populations that are highly similar in their deep ancestral composition. The secret is to focus on the recent shared history of the analyzed populations, instead of the ancient shared history. When a sufficiently large number of samples are analyzed together, it is possible to find segments of the genome in which pairs of individuals share close ancestors over the last approximately 40 generations. And by focusing on these segments of the genome, we can learn what happened in human history over this time frame, roughly 1,000 years. With the small numbers of samples that have been available in ancient DNA studies so far, These methods have not been particularly useful, because it is only the rare pair of individuals who are closely enough related to share identical long stretches of DNA. But as the number of individuals for whom we have ancient DNA increases, the number of pairs that we can analyze in order to detect relatedness increases according to the square of the number of samples. At the rate at which ancient DNA data are now being produced, it is reasonable to expect that within a few years, a single laboratory like mine will be producing genome-wide data from thousands of ancient people a year. This will make it possible to provide a detailed chronicle of how human populations have changed over recent millennia. The power of this approach can already be seen in the 2015 study, The People of the British Isles, which sampled more than 2,000 present-day individuals from the United Kingdom, whose four grandparents were all born within 80 kilometers of one another. The study found that the British population was very homogeneous by conventional measures. For example, the classic measure of genetic differentiation between two British populations is about 100 times smaller than the same measurement of population differentiation comparing Europeans to East Asians. Despite the homogeneity, however, the authors were able to cluster the British population into 17 crisply defined groups by searching for groups in which all pairs of individuals have elevated rates of recently shared genetic ancestors. Plotting the positions onto a map, they observed extraordinary genetic structuring, which has persisted despite the fact that people have moved back and forth continually over the British countryside over the past millennium, a process that would have been expected to homogenize the population. The boundaries of the clusters mark out the border between the southwestern counties of Devon and Cornwall, the Orkney Islands off the north coast of Scotland, a largely undifferentiated cluster crossing the Irish Sea, reflecting the migration of Scottish Protestants to Northern Ireland within the last few centuries, and within Northern Ireland, two distinctive and barely mixing clusters, which surely correspond to the Protestant and Catholic populations, divided by religion and hundreds of years of enmity under British rule. The success of this analysis, performed only on present-day people, gives hope for extending the approach to samples that are more ancient. In my laboratory, we already have generated genome-wide data on more than 300 ancient Britons. Co-analyzing them with present-day Britons, including those from the People of the British Isles study, we expect to be able to connect the dots between the past and the present in this one small part of the world. Ancient DNA studies with large numbers of samples also offer the promise of being able to estimate human population sizes at different times in the past, a topic about which we have almost no reliable information from the period earlier than the invention of writing, but which is important for understanding not just human history and evolution, but also economics and ecology. In a population of many hundreds of millions, such as the Han Chinese, a pair of randomly chosen people is expected to have few, if any, shared segments of DNA within the last 40 generations, because they descend from almost entirely different ancestors over this period. By contrast, in a small population, like the indigenous people of Little Andaman Island, who have a census size of fewer than 100, all pairs of individuals are closely related and will show evidence of relatedness through many shared segments of DNA. Measuring how related people are has been used to show, correctly, that the size of the population of England in the last few centuries has averaged many millions. In ongoing work, Pierre Palomera and I have demonstrated that the same approach can be used to show that early farmers from Anatolia of around 8,000 years ago, were part of much larger populations than the hunter-gatherers from southern Sweden who were their contemporaries, as expected based on the higher densities that can be supported by agriculture. I have no doubt that applying this approach to ancient DNA will provide rich insight into how populations changed in size over time. Ancient DNA's promise for revealing human biology. Ancient DNA, in principle, has just as much insight to offer about how human biology has changed over time as it does about human migrations and mixtures. And yet, while the power of ancient DNA to reveal population transformations has been a runaway success, so far the insights into human biology have been limited. A key reason is that to track human biological change over time, it is important to be able to study how mutation frequencies change. But this requires hundreds of samples. And to date, the sample sizes of ancient DNA have been relatively small, just a handful from each cultural context. What will happen once we have genome-wide data from 1,000 European farmers living shortly after the transition to agriculture? Comparing the results of a scan for recent natural selection in these individuals to the same scan performed in present-day Europeans should make it possible to understand whether the pace and nature of human adaptation has changed between pre-agricultural times and the time since the transition to agriculture. It might even be possible to determine whether natural selection has slowed down in the last century. Due to medical advances that allow individuals with genetic conditions that would have prevented them from surviving and having families to live and procreate. Examples of such medical conditions include poor eyesight, which can now be fully corrected with spectacles, or infertility, which can now be corrected by medical interventions, or cognitive challenges, which can now be controlled by medication and psychotherapy. It is possible that this change in natural selection is leading to a buildup of mutations, contributing to altering these traits in the population. The power of ancient DNA to track the rate at which the frequencies of biologically important mutations have changed is important, not just because it offers the possibility of tracking the evolution of specific traits, but also because it provides a previously unavailable tool that we can use to understand the fundamental principles of how natural selection proceeds. A central question in human evolutionary biology is whether human evolution typically proceeds by large changes in mutation frequencies at relatively small numbers of positions in the genome, as in the case of pigmentation, or by small changes in frequencies at a very large number of mutations, as in the case of height. Understanding the relative importance of each type of adaptation is important, but addressing this question is made more challenging when the only tool available is analysis of people all of whom lived in a single window of time. Ancient DNA overcomes this obstacle, the time trap of only being able to study the present. Ancient DNA research also reveals pathogen evolution. When grinding up human remains, we sometimes encounter DNA from microorganisms that were in an individual's bloodstream when he or she died, and so were the likely cause of death. This approach proved that the bacterium Yersinia pestis was the cause of the 14th to 17th century CE Black Death, the 6th to 8th century CE Justinianic Plague of the Roman Empire, and an endemic plague that was responsible for at least about 7% of deaths in skeletons from burials across the Eurasian steppe after around 5,000 years ago. Ancient pathogen studies have also revealed the history and origins of ancient leprosy, tuberculosis, and in plants, the Irish potato famine. Ancient DNA studies are now regularly obtaining material from the microbes that inhabit us, including from dental plaque and feces, providing information about the food our ancestors ate. We are only just beginning to mine this new seam of information. Taming the Wild West of the Ancient DNA Revolution. The speed at which the ancient DNA revolution is moving is exhilarating. The technology is evolving so quickly that many papers being published right now use methods that will be obsolete within a few years. Ancient DNA specialists are multiplying. For example, my own laboratory has already graduated 3 people who have founded their own ancient DNA laboratories. A major trend is specialization. The pioneers of ancient DNA spent a large portion of their time traveling the world to remote locations, talking with archaeologists and local officials, and bringing back unique remains that they had then analyzed in their molecular biology laboratories. Travel to exotic places and a gold rush to obtain key bones are central to this way of doing science. Some in the second generation of ancient DNA research have adopted this model. But others, including myself, travel far less and instead spend most of our time developing expertise in improved laboratory techniques or statistical analysis, obtaining the samples we study through increasingly equal partnerships with archaeologists and anthropologists. Ancient DNA laboratories will also become more specialized. At present, we who are working on ancient DNA have the privilege of doing research on populations from all over the world and from a wide range of times. We are like Robert Hooke, turning his microscope to describe an extraordinary array of tiny objects in his book Micrographia, or like explorers in the late 18th century, sailing to every corner of the globe. But we have at best a superficial knowledge of the historic, an archaeological and linguistic background of any topic we work on. And as knowledge grows, a deeper understanding of each region and the specific questions associated with it will be needed to make progress. Over the next 2 decades, I expect that ancient DNA specialists will be hired into every serious department of anthropology and archaeology, even history and biology. The professionals hired into these roles will be specialized in studying particular areas. For example, Southeast Asia or Northeast China, and their research will not flit from China to America, to Europe, to Africa, as mine does today. Ancient DNA will also go the way of specialization and even professionalization when it comes to setting up service laboratories, analogous to the service laboratories that exist for radiocarbon dating. Ancient DNA service laboratories will screen samples, generate genome-wide data, and provide reports that are easily interpretable, much like those currently provided by commercial, personal ancestry testing companies. The reports will determine species, sex, and family relationships, and reveal how newly studied individuals relate to individuals for whom there is previously reported data. The researchers submitting the samples will receive an electronic copy of the data to use in any way they wish. The whole process shouldn't cost more than twice what radiocarbon dating does. Service laboratories will proliferate, but researchers analyzing the data to study population history will never be entirely replaced. Archaeologists interested in learning about ancient populations using DNA will always need to partner with experts in genomics if they wish to use the technology to address any question that has subtlety. Getting information about sex, species, family relatedness, and ancestry outliers from ancient DNA will eventually be routine. But deeper scientific questions that can be accessed with ancient DNA data, such as how populations mixed and migrated, and how natural selection occurred over time, are unlikely ever to be addressed adequately through standardized reports. The future for ancient DNA laboratories that I find appealing is based on a model that has emerged among radiocarbon dating laboratories. For example, the Oxford Radiocarbon Accelerator Unit processes large numbers of samples for a fee and uses this income stream to support a factory that churns out routine dates and produces data more cheaply, efficiently, and at a higher quality than would be possible if its scientists limited themselves to their own questions. But its scientists then piggyback on the juggernaut of the radiocarbon dating factory they have built to do cutting-edge science, such as the study led by Thomas Higgum that clarified the record on the demise of Neanderthals in Europe, showing that they disappeared everywhere within a few thousand years of contact with modern humans. This is also the model that I learned when I was a postdoctoral scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, at one of the half-dozen sequencing centers that carried out the brute force work for the Human Genome Project, funded by large data production contracts from the U.S. National Institutes of Health. The center's leader, my supervisor, Eric Lander, also took advantage of the fact that he could turn the power of his sequencing center to address scientific problems that intrigued him. This is my model, too, to build a factory, and then to commandeer it to answer deep questions about the past. Out of respect for ancient bones. I first went to Jerusalem when I was 7 years old, taken there by my mother, along with my older brother and younger sister. We stayed that summer and the next in an apartment that my grandfather owned in a poor, ultra-Orthodox neighborhood, populated by men dressed in long black caftans and women in layered, modest dresses and headscarves. The boys attended morning-to-night religious schools, but on Friday afternoons, before the Sabbath, they were dismissed early and often joined political demonstrations. During the protests, they sometimes set fire to dumpsters and pelted policemen with stones. I remember watching the boys running, cloths pressed to faces, eyes streaming from the tear gas lobbed at them by the police. Some of these protests were in response to excavations in the City of David, a site that spills down the hillside of the Temple Mount, south of the Old City of Jerusalem, and covers much of the area that became the capital of Judea after about 3,000 years ago. The protesters were upset that the excavations would disturb ancient Jewish graves, an ever-present possibility when digging in Israel. For the protesters, the opening of graves, whether by accident or for scientific investigation, was desecration. What would those protesters think of what my laboratory is doing now? Grinding through the bones of hundreds of ancient people every month. Perhaps they would not care much about samples from outside Israel, but I think the issue is more general. And I have found myself reflecting more and more about opening up the graves and sampling the remains of any ancient human. It is likely that many of the people whose bones we sample would not have wanted their remains to be used in this way. One argument that some ancient DNA specialists and archaeologists have made is that most of the skeletons we are studying are from cultures so remote in time that they have no traceable connection to peoples of the present. This is the standard encoded in law in the U.S. Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, which states that remains should be returned to Native American tribes when there is evidence of a cultural or biological connection to present-day peoples. However, this standard is now breaking down, as exemplified by the approximately 8,500-year-old Kennewick man skeleton and the approximately 10,600-year-old Spirit Cave skeleton that are being returned to tribes despite having no clear cultural or genetic connections to specific groups living today. As we study skeletons that draw ever closer in time to the present, it is important to think about the implications of modern claims on ancient samples. Ancient remains are the remains of real people, whose physical integrity we should perhaps only violate if we have good reasons. In 2016, I decided to ask a rabbi, in this case my mother's brother, for counsel. He is Orthodox, which means that he follows the intricate rules specified in the Jewish oral tradition. I had a hope that he might be open to my question, as he has also been an advocate for adapting Orthodox Judaism as much as possible to the modern world, while abiding by the constraints of its fixed rules, a movement of inclusivity that has been called Open Orthodoxy. Most recently, he set up a religious seminary to train women as Orthodox rabbis, a role from which women in that community had previously been excluded. I told him that in my lab we were grinding through the bones of ancient peoples, many of whom might not have wanted their remains to be disturbed, and that I felt I had not thought enough about this. He was obviously troubled and asked me for some time to think. Afterward, he came back with the judgment a rabbi gives to provide guidance when there is no precedent set by earlier decisions or judgments made by other rabbis. He said, "All human graves are sacrosanct, but there are mitigating circumstances that make it permissible to open graves, as long as there is potential to promote understanding, to break down barriers between people." The study of human variation has not always been a force for good. In Nazi Germany, someone with my expertise at interpreting genetic data would have been tasked with categorizing people by ancestry, had that been possible, with the science of the 1930s. But in our time, the findings from ancient DNA leave little solace for racist or nationalistic misinterpretation. In this field, the pursuit of truth for its own sake has overwhelmingly had the effect of exploding stereotypes, undercutting prejudice, and highlighting the connections among peoples not previously known to be related. I am optimistic that the direction of my work and that of my colleagues is to promote understanding, and I welcome our opportunity to do our best by the people, ancient and modern, whom we have been given the privilege to study. I see it as our role to midwife ancient DNA into a field that is not only the domain of geneticists, but also of archaeologists and the public, to realize its extraordinary potential to reveal who we are. This concludes the reading of Who We Are and How We Got Here, Ancient DNA and the New Science of the Human Past by David Reich. Copyright 2018 by David Reich and Eugenie Reich. This book was read by John Lesko. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Brockman Incorporated and was produced in 2018 by Blackstone Publishing, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Publishing. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.